Welcome back to View from the Roundhouse. It is Friday, the 11th of October, and I am Anna Baser. We welcome back our wonderful collaborator, Professor of Politics, Martin Drum from Notre Dame here in Fremantle. Welcome back, Martin.
Thank you, Anna. It's great to be with you on the Fremantle Shipping News.
It's been a significant week at home and afar. This Monday, October 7th, marked 1 year since the deadly Hamas-led attack, as fighting continues in Gaza and Lebanon. Memorials, vigils, and protests were held across the world to commemorate the lives lost in this conflict. Martin, looking at the past 365 days, was this something that political scientists were expecting?
In short, no. I don't think people were expecting it to be as bad as it was before October the 7th. There was a lot of tension. There was many unresolved issues and low-level violence that were taking place. We don't have time for a full history of the sad history of the Israel-Palestine conflict, but certainly October the 7th and all the events that followed represented a whole new level of violence. Obviously, atrocities on October the 7th, and then the very violent response by Israel have set back peace efforts enormously, distressed many families and people on both sides. I think you saw some of the anguish on the memorial for October the 7th that many Jewish people have felt. It's been an awful experience for them. It's also an awful experience for the many victims and their families in Gaza as well. So I don't think we ever saw this coming. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of light at the end of the tunnel at the moment.
When you mentioned there's not a whole lot to look forward to, Israel has vowed to attack Iran in retaliation. What can we expect Israel's efforts to look like, responding to Iran's attack?
It's a really good question, Anna. I don't think they're going to be in the business of telegraphing those, of course. So it's only conjecture. It would appear from the noises coming out that's less likely to be around oil export facilities. But there's a lot of, I think, behind the scenes negotiation between US and Israel. I don't think US has the leverage on Israel that they would like in this respect. What's the US trying to achieve? They recognize that Israel will strike back against Iran, but they want to avoid the conflagration of the complete Middle East and then further escalation. So they would rather that Israel strikes back in a manner which draws a line under this rather than in a manner that then causes Iran to retaliate again and things to get worse and worse and worse. So that's the plan that they're trying to thrash out at the moment, whether Biden still has any leverage over Netanyahu. I guess we'll see, and maybe the nature of the strike, Anna, might lend some insight into that.
And just bringing in the US election briefly into that, do we expect that the new presidential elect, who that may be, whether that be Harris or Trump, do we think that they can have potentially more leverage than Biden, or as a whole, the US just doesn't have a lot of power in speaking to Israel?
Yeah, I think that the whole issue has been difficult for Biden and will be and proving difficult for Harris as well. Harris is, of course, Biden's vice president. I'm not sure she'll have any more leverage over Netanyahu. Trump is an interesting character because he kind of does his own thing. I think he's likely to give Netanyahu a really free rein. He has less qualms about these things, but then perhaps insists that some kind of deal is made to draw a line under it. I think that's probably his rationale, whether he's successful or not. I mean, there are deep emotional attachments to positions in both Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas, and other people in this conflict. It's not as easy to draw the line under it that you think it is.
Absolutely. You make a very good point there, Martin. Moving a little bit closer to home, Parliament has been sitting in session this week as current Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is in Laos for the ASEAN conference. We're expecting the federal election to be called relatively soon in the next few months. What's been on top of the government's agenda?
The government has found it difficult seizing control of the narrative and getting on the front foot and taking the fight to the opposition. Albanese, I think, has struggled in recent times to really present a commanding presence. It wasn't helped this week with a gaffe, some comments reflecting on Tourette's syndrome, which he was forced to apologize profusely for. These things don't probably help his momentum, and he's getting attacked for being weak and ineffectual. Well, I mean, leaders are either weak and ineffectual or they're arrogant and pompous. You can't win sometimes in leadership, but I think they've really got to get on the front foot and get some clear po new policy positions out in the next 1 to 2 months so that they finish the year strong and they've got something clear to take to the 22 election. Because it's just a sense the government's drifting a little bit and Peter Dutton's making the most of that.
Do we have any indication on what some of these policies could look like?
I think they'll be very closely focused around cost of living and economic areas. That's the area where he's been attacked on, and that's where I think he'll be trying to respond. I think we've talked about this a little bit recently. It's a difficult one. You don't have a lot of levers to attack this because you spend a lot of money, then it drives up prices. But you'll have to try and find a few things that really address these concerns very directly.
And then Albanese met with the Chinese Premier to discuss trade tariffs. Was this an important meeting and what did it signify?
Yes, in short, it was a very important meeting, and there've been a series of important meetings with China. The last of the trade restrictions on WA lobsters, no less, Anna. So get your lobster fast because they're going to be exported to China. But look, this is a good outcome for that. It's a fairly smallish industry, but a good outcome for that industry. Under this has been a significant achievement by the government. It often gets forgotten, but a whole range of export industries, including some WA farmers here, because that's more export related, WA's sector, were in deep strife because they couldn't export to their most popular market. Wineries were suffering as well. There's a range of important areas. It might be a little bit forgotten. It's sort of kind of drifted off into the rearview mirror, but it did make a difference in those industries. And having a positive relationship with China, with perhaps without perhaps being forced to sign up to any human rights statements, etc., is important. They are our number one trade partner. We can't get around that, and I can assure listeners that they're pretty important to the WA economy as well through our mineral resources sector. So it has been step by step a relatively strong achievement.
So, a pretty good move by Albanese then this week. Senator Fatima Payman has announced her new political party, Australia's Voice, this week. Personally, I find that the name bears significant resemblance to the Voice of Parliament referendum held early this year. Is this similarity going to cause any issues, Martin?
It's been picked up. It could be an issue. The other problem that Senator Payman has is that whenever you set up a political party, for it to have any length and legs, it's got to appeal to a really clear demographic. Is it left? Is it right? Is it supporting this group or not that group? It's not clear to me exactly what, I think it's kind of maybe in teal territory, perhaps. But you've already got teals. You've got Greens and on the left, and so it's not, it's going to have strong competition from the Greens with some policies, perhaps. We haven't had Senator Payman release any of these policies. We don't know for sure. We know that she lines up with the Greens on Palestine, but we don't know a lot else about her views. She'll need to articulate those really clearly to have to stand for something. That's really important. I'll give her some time to do that. She's only just announced her party, so we'll see. But you've really got to occupy a clear place in the spectrum to capitalise on that. That's really important in terms of your strategy. Glenn Jury, who's advising her, does have a lot of experience in that area. So I expect there'll be something coming out, but until that happens, it's really difficult to know exactly where that considered support was coming from. There was some talk, Anna, that it was going to be a Muslim party, appealing to people of the Muslim faith. That's not evident yet. That might come, but it's not evident yet. And then, of course, we don't have a strong history of of political parties based purely around certain things. We've got certain, Australian Christians and this and that and the other. They've tended to come and go. They haven't been lasting, haven't lasting impact on political systems at the national level, at least in Australia. I guess we'll see.
And how has the government reacted to this, considering Payman was a Labor senator before stepping down in April?
Look, it's been a nagging problem for the Albanese government. So even if Senator Payman's party candidates don't get up, they still may take some votes away from Labor and the Greens. And that's an uncomfortable reality for the Albanese government. They spent some time trying to placate Senator Payman. I think they're more likely to be more derisory now, especially once a political party has been established. It has presented some problems, particularly in Western Sydney, where significant demographic and Muslim demographic is there, and where some of the safest Labor seats are and some of the ministers come from.
Yes, we'll have to see for the next federal election whether her new party will garner the support of the public. Now, I'm not much of a sports watcher, however, the proposal for the inclusion of a WA team in the NRL has gained a bit of attention. The Western Bears, who are they and why have we heard so much about them?
I'll give you a really super quick history for non-rugby league people. Plenty of people in our eastern states are very familiar with rugby league, but it's not had as strong a history in WA. There's this group called the North. There's a team called the North Sydney Bears in northern Sydney in New South Wales that were dropped out of the competition when it came back together after a split. Anyway, a lot of residual supporters from the North Sydney Bears that still play at the local level have always aspired to bring that team back together and back in. They've got some following, local following there. They wanted to band together with a WA syndicate, so it would be the Western Bears and play some of their games in Western Australia and some of their games in Northern Sydney. It was an interesting proposal. They are talking about an extra team in the NRL. However, there were some concerns the NRL had, and they've knocked back that bid, and they're unhappy with some of the investors, apparently, according to news reports. I don't think the proposal's completely dead. I think there's an opportunity to rework it. But for Perth people, we're out of the game in one of the biggest sports in Australia. We did have a team called the Western Reds quite a few years ago, didn't last, folded, etc. So I think there's a small but fairly loyal and dedicated following here in Western Australia that would really like to see that happen.
And could this Perth-based team bring something to the economy?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Rugby league has, they don't attract quite the same crowds as AFL does, but they've got a big TV rights deal and a lot of people watch it. And there are some people internationally in places like UK and New Zealand as well. And it would be healthy and helpful for WA to have a presence.
And Martin, do you think there is a chance of this actually happening?
I think there is. I don't think the proposal's dead. I think the state government, there might be more onus on them to coordinate that proposal further, help rework it, throw a few more things into the mix. Ironically, one of the other ideas for expansion is actually in PNG. So, that might get precedence. That's another development area for the NRL, the Rugby League. And I think the Commonwealth government has been very involved there in trying to use it as a development tool. It's a very popular sport in Papua New Guinea. Not as big a population, not as big a financial basis. So, they've got the strengths and weaknesses there.
I guess we'll have to watch this space, and time will tell. The latest Times Higher Education World University ranking have been released, and Australia's universities have slid in the ranks. Melbourne University has been the top institution within Australia for the past 15 years. It's retained its pole position, however, has still slipped. How is this ranking system calculated, and why are Australian universities sliding down?
It's a good question, and practically all of the top universities slid. So it was a bit demoralising. for Australian universities. It's only one of a number of ranking systems internationally, but it's one of the most famous. It has a strong component in research, but there's also a teaching component, a graduate component, and a few other factors that are thrown in. It does reflect some weakness in the Australian tertiary sector even before the international caps came in. So international caps is a very recent development and wouldn't have had time to feed into these ranking slides, but it both does talk to the sector being challenged already, and then you've got other policy settings that it has to deal with and manage. The only way up the rankings for major universities is to invest in key areas and to put more resources in, and particularly into research, innovation and impact, and the quality of teaching and the graduate outcomes. That takes a bit of time, and you need to find revenue sources in order to do that effectively.
And the release of these rankings, what sort of impact does this have on public perception and the universities themselves?
Good question. It does have lots of ancillary impacts. So it's in terms of attracting global research opportunities, that's in, they're important. Attracting international students from other places, that's important. The rankings are important to that. Partnerships, so global partnerships, whether it's UN or major multinational firms to sponsor research, etc. A whole range of things are related to those rankings. So it does get a bit harder to make progress in those areas if you don't have the name and the brand accordingly.
And then lastly, a little bit closer to home, here in Fremantle, the Fremantle Chamber of Commerce Awards were held last night. Can you tell me what happened there, Martin?
Oh, well, it was an exciting evening, and I think it's good that the Fremantle, some of the Fremantle faithful get together. And the biggest winners, there were some fantastic winners across 14 categories, and the biggest winner, I think, take home was Little Creatures. So Little Creatures operations manager Mel Jacobs won Business Person of the Year, but they won the Hall of Fame award as well. Lots of other awards, I think Gage Roads and Maritime Museum and Digital Hitman and all sorts of different other companies were award winners. But hats off to Little Creatures on a fantastic effort in taking home the major awards. And it's great to see so many fantastic people in and around Fremantle being celebrated.
Yes, Fremantle is definitely a beautiful place for community. I would love to keep picking your brain, Martin, but we seem to have run out of time yet again. Thank you for taking the time out of your day, and we will reconvene next week.
Thank you, Anna. Always a pleasure.